You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education podcast, where I'm joined by Dr. Shirley Ann Jackson, who's president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in the US, and John Kolb, who is vice president for information services and technology and chief information officer at the same institution. It's a pleasure to meet you both.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I noticed you spoke last year at the Royal Academy of Engineering, and one of the topics you touched on was big data. It seems to be it's a buzzword to an extent. People are always talking about it. What we're trying to find out is how universities can make the most of it to develop, you know, their own practices. I understand you've made fairly significant changes at Rensselaer to make the use of the data sets that the university collects.
Well, when I spoke at the Royal Academy of Engineering last year, I actually talked about it within the context of what I call the new polytechnic. And the new polytechnic really has two sort of streams that link that are important. One has to do with the fact that there is an explosion of data. But it's not just the data alone. It's about the fact that what we do is increasingly web-enabled. Mm-hmm. We have enormous computational power, so supercomputer power. And then the global connectivity that the very web and social networks and so on allow. And so those things create both challenges and opportunities for people to come together in unique ways to use the capabilities to solve global challenges. Mm-hmm. And so that's the second key point. But to solve those global challenges requires the ability for people to work in a geographically and time-dispersed way. And that's what the interconnectivity allows. But it also means that people have to be able to bring disciplines together, because most challenges at their root are social, because they involve people and human decision-making. So the new polytechnic idea talks about bringing people together across disciplines, including those in the social sciences, as well as making use of a breadth of technological enablements, including the explosion of data. So we have not just tweets and text messages and those sorts of things, but there are sensors of various kinds, sensors in cars. There are sensors in the ocean to detect the formation of tsunamis. There are sensors that monitor weather fronts. There are satellite-based sensors, airborne sensors, sea and land sensors.
Can you give me an example of something on the campus, for example, with students' data? Because universities have these data sets available to them. Is there anything at your institution that you're doing to make sure you're making the most of that?
Well, what we are particularly focused on is not just looking at, you know, how and where and when students check in and out of the library, but actually to tie in data on cognition and learning, to extract ways to teach students better and how to engage them, how web enablement is important, but teaching students as well how to make use of the web. And you might say, well, don't they already know? Well, when you're educating scientists and engineers, the validation of data is important, because the internet does not come with a credibility filter. And so a challenge is to teach students how to take data and, in the actual use of it, to learn how to validate it, as well as developing automated tools that allow cross-correlation studies and things like that. So we're embedding it into our pedagogy, and I think that's where some of the greatest opportunity lies. You know, there's a lot of discussion about MOOCs, you know, the massive open online courses. I think the jury is out on that, but one thing that it does allow is the collection of an enormous amount of data in terms of how students learn and the effectiveness of the proposed methodologies and pedagogies.
Let me build on what President Jackson said. And most of our focus is educating the leaders of tomorrow that are going to understand how to take these massive data sets, and some of them are sets, some of them are not sets, and combine them. And that's the fun part, is that when people talk about big data, they typically talk in terms of volume, the volume of the data. But the variability that the president mentioned, being able to verify the credibility of your sources, taking structured data, unstructured data, social data, physical data, companies may have proprietary data, combining that with public data, and then sort of mashing that all together to come up with information that's actionable. We have programs of business analytics in supply chain management and so on, that in addition to IT and computer science and engineering, with just that in mind, that the people that come to Rensselaer are going to be very good at taking all that together, and some of them are going to be down in the machines working on it, some of them are going to be business leaders that take it and then do something with it.
So it's a skills gap to an extent. There aren't people out there who know how to mine this data. The data scientists don't exist, so the universities of today need to make sure we're preparing the data scientists of tomorrow.
Absolutely, but one has to also educate them with how do you build in social decision making with and through the use of the data. And so what we've done at Rensselaer is to develop a series of platforms and capabilities that allow us to do that. So we formed what we call the Rensselaer IDEA, big idea, which stands for the Institute for Data Exploration and Applications. But it combines everything from traditional computer science, to web science, to cognitive computing and artificial intelligence, to social network science and technology, to create a panoply of capabilities that can apply across a range of problems, such as looking, developing what people refer to as agent-based models that can have implications having to do with the effect of human decision making, whether you're talking in financial systems, things from how do you look at incentives for smart electricity pricing, really understand that, even looking at imperfect financial markets. But in order to do that, one has to marry a kind of artificial intelligence, the use of intelligent agents, with computational capabilities that also depend upon being able to aggregate and organize and validate the data. And so these are huge, and these are complicated.
Dr. Jackson, you've been president since 1999 of Rensselaer, entering your 15th year. Congratulations, indeed. I noticed the website lists a great many of your achievements during your illustrious career. I know you've been appointed to the President's Council of Advisors, that was by Obama in 2009. You hold a PhD in elementary particle physics from MIT, not to mention sort of your record at Rensselaer. But a lot of them relate to your African-American background. The website states you were the first African-American to serve as chair of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and indeed the first African-American woman to lead a top 50 research university. I think it's fair to say in the UK we're some way off a black female vice-chancellor. There certainly isn't any precedent for it, and current vice-chancellors, you could argue, come from a fairly narrow group. I mean, what's your opinion on that scenario in the UK?
Well, I try not to speak about things I don't know a whole lot about, and so I don't profess to know what all of the factors are in the UK in particular. What I do understand more about is the United States. And I'm one who believes that when one is the first this or the first that, it is a combination of what the individual does, but it's also a statement about what the society is ready for and what the opportunities are. And so I've always said to young people that we all come through our windows in time. And when we do, a certain window or door can open, and one has to be prepared to step through it. And because of what happened in the U.S. societally and my own family background, you know, I was able to step through my window in time. And what I mean by that is that I grew up in a time when two major events happened very close in time, not coincident, but very close. One was the integration of public schools following on the heels of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which integrated the public schools in Washington, D.C., where I grew up, which meant that I was able to go to schools where there was more competition and more resources and so on than I had exposure to before that. But the other was the Soviet launch of Sputnik 1, which riveted the attention in the U.S. on, you know, the space race, which was really a science-based defense race. And so there was a lot of focus on taking students who had talent and interest in science and math and creating opportunities and educating them for careers in the STEM fields, as we call them today.
Yeah.
And so that those things happened, but I happened to grow up in a family that valued education very high. And my father was mechanically gifted, and he didn't have a lot of formal education beyond high school. In fact, none. But he was very good in math and in mechanical things. And my mother was very strong in the language arts. In fact, she was a teacher for a number of years. And she taught all of us to read before we went to kindergarten, too. We began primary school. So we kind of had that. And then I had my natural interest and curiosity in mathematics, actually, early on, but also in what was going on in the natural world around me. So I came through that window in time. And then I think that opened other opportunities. They weren't easy pathways. I could sit and regale you with stories about various challenges I faced along the way. But with each of the sets of challenges, each of the sets of challenges were the result of a window opening that I stepped through. But I also think it's important that when one does that, and that opportunity presents itself, that one makes a difference. And that's what I've always tried to do. So, you know, I've never thought and been content that I was the first African American or first Black this or that. But then, having done that, having stepped through that window, what then was I going to do? And so I tried to do it with the research I did when I was doing research, with the teaching I did when I was a professor, with the NRC, where I reorganized the agency. I changed its whole regulatory approach to risk-informed, performance-based regulation. I spearheaded the formation of an International Nuclear Regulators Association involving eight major nuclear power countries. The UK was one of the first members. In fact, the head regulator here succeeded me as the chairman of that group, and it still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the changes I've been able with my team to bring about at the university, and I hope leave an indelible mark in terms of where we've gone, how we've developed our plans, and what we've accomplished under those plans. Those things matter to me. So to be able to open a door, to be, you know, a model for young people who may need models to aspire to certain things and know they can do certain things, that makes me feel good. But it also matters because I've been able to do things that are important and unique. And that's also an important part of the message.
What's next for you in your role at the university? I I understand you have a couple of plans in place, the Rensselaer plan and the Rensselaer plan 2024, is it? That's a landmark year for the university, isn't it? Tell me a bit more about those plans and what they're going to entail.
Well, I'll start, and then I'm going to, because John's also, he's an alum of the university, so he can give you some historical perspective.
Please.
You know, Rensselaer was started by Stephen Van Rensselaer, who was a Dutch patroon. He owned a lot of the land that is now Rensselaer County in upstate New York. And he started the university. He was also a member of the Congress, U.S. Congress from New York State, but very wealthy man. So with a gentleman by the name of Amos Eaton, who actually inspired the original pedagogy of the university, he founded the university. And the original approach to the education was embodied in what was then called the Rensselaerian Plan. So when presidents are hired, many times they develop strategic plans for the university. And they give them names, the 21st century blueprint or whatever. And my thought was the Rensselaerian idea had persisted by the time I came for 175 years. And so for me, my challenge was to create the 21st century embodiment of the Rensselaerian idea. So there was a Rensselaerian plan, so we developed the Rensselaer plan, which was that 21st century embodiment. And we created it with a series of commitment statements. We will do this, we will do that, we will do this, we will do that. And we say we operate across the four P's: people, programs, platforms, and partnerships. People, because to do important things, you need talented people. You gotta hire them, you gotta develop them, you gotta give them the opportunity. They develop the programs that have impact and position the university. The platforms enable them, but it's also a way to manage the university and optimize our use of resources. And then that kind of thing, all of this is enabled by the partnerships, but the partnerships are also an outgrowth of the accomplishments we make. So John, maybe you could share some of your thoughts about the plans.
Well, but you asked before, Chris, to give an example how all this comes together. So when the president mentioned people, platforms, partnerships, and programs, let me go through what we've done a little bit in the IT arena. We've put in place a couple of pretty amazing platforms. So we have, I believe we're the only university in the world that's running the Watson software. The Watson software, this is a derivative of the software that played in the game Jeopardy and beat the human contestants. So we have an instance of that work running on our campus. So our cognitive science folks and our cognitive systems folks are working on that new programs around that platform. And we have some of the best people in the world in that area. They're the folks that developed this IT and Web Science program. They're the people that are leading the IDEA Institute that the president mentioned before. So there's the people, the programs, the platform, and of course the partnership in that case is with IBM. International Business Machines Corporation has been just a great partner with us to get these things off the ground. Alongside that, we actually have a supercomputer that just went over a petaflop. Now, PETA, since this is a podcast, we better be careful here. The PETA is a quadrillion calculation. So this does a quadrillion floating point operations per second. You can think if the world has on the order of 7 billion, we're somewhere around, 150,000 calculations per person in the world per second.
Right.
And that's the kind of power that we have sitting right alongside Watson. By the way, we named that after our founding intellectual leader. We named it Amos. So Advanced Multi-Processing Optimized System. So we had to come up with some sort of acronym, and it was Amos. So, but with those two...
It's a running theme.
So the beauty of it is that Watson, Thomas J. Watson, was founder of IBM. and the T.J. Watson Research Center is really named for him. Amos, who helped to found Rensselaer.
So it's really those two founders coming together in a very unique way for the 21st century of, you know, how are we going to educate this next generation of students to be leaders in not just data mining, but cognitive systems, supercomputing, modeling, analytics, predictive calculations, and so on. Mm-hmm. And how do you put all that together? And I couldn't agree more with the president that, yes, we're developing people that have that particular set of skills, but it's really, they're doing it as scientists, as engineers, as humanists, as business leaders, and so on. And so this is just a core of their education that they'll have at Rensselaer. Sure. And that's very exciting, because this really, I think, is the 21st century. And it's kind of fun when you think of our 200, now, when we say 200 in the U.S., that means a long time. When we say 200 over here, it doesn't mean such a long time, but for us, this is a pretty significant milestone.
Absolutely.
And, it's kind of fun.
And Rensselaer is the oldest technological university in the United States, certainly the oldest private.
Sure.
It's had a great history in terms of impact.
Very quickly, in the last 5 minutes before we wrap this up, I did want to get both of your opinions on two topics really that have run through US higher education for a while. One being off the back of last week's White House summit held by President Obama, which was about getting disadvantaged people into higher education. And the second being graduation rates, which when we in the UK look at the US, we sort of sometimes think that the graduation rates in the US are quite low, certainly compared to other developed nations or OECD nations, if you like. So there's a very quickly caveated questions, but I would like to get your thoughts on those two things, and obviously from the Rensselaer perspective, what your plans are doing to address those two issues.
Thank you. Well, I'll start. You know, there is access, and then as you rightfully point out, there's completion, and then what happens to students once they graduate. Now, we happen to have quite a good overall graduation rate, much higher than the national norms in the U.S.
What is that?
It's on the order of, you know, this thing is calculated over a six-year period. So it's about 85 running, you know, higher every year. But the big point is the freshman to sophomore retention. And if you don't have that first to second year retention, you tend to lose a lot of the students. So we have focused there a lot. So one of the issues having to do with access is preparation. And there are a number of places that will opt students out because they're not prepared. And at Rensselaer, a student has to have a certain strength, particularly in mathematics, in order to be able to handle our curriculum. And we have pretty high, you know, SAT scores, standardized test scores for of the entering students. So the issue is, how do you then deal with that if you have students who come from disadvantaged backgrounds where they would not naturally do necessarily as well, although most of the minority students we get, you know, have pretty good preparations. So we're using these new technologies to create a bridge, to use online methods, you know, MOOC-type methods, to reach into students before they would come to Rensselaer in order to strengthen their preparation along certain lines, but as well to look at the cultural issues and social issues when they're on the campus to create more of a welcoming environment and a supportive environment. And then the important thing as well is to create opportunity pathways where students have things from internships to certain kinds of summer jobs, to certain kinds of on-campus experiences, getting involved with faculty research. And on a relative basis, we have a fairly small number, not unlike a lot of technological universities, of underrepresented minority students, and less than a 50-50 mix of women as well. So we're working pretty hard on that, and in our plan, we explicitly call out that we're going to do a number of things. When I talk about the commitment statements, they're in the plan, and you have the plan now. And so now we're living that. And then, of course, when students come from disadvantaged backgrounds, one has to worry about their ability to afford higher education. And ours is an expensive one because we're technologically rooted. And so financial aid is something that we have strengthened over the years, and we're strengthening even more, meaning putting more money to it, especially for students from disadvantaged backgrounds.
Well, just quickly to add to that, and before the president asked me to give a little bit of a historical perspective, given that I'm an alum, I actually sat in a large lecture hall as an incoming freshman student, and I was told to look to the right, look to the left, and one or two of you are not going to make it through here. And it was kind of this mentality of gatekeeper, and you either made it through the gatekeepers or you didn't make it through the gatekeepers. And we actually encourage our students now, the president does, and says, look to your right, look to your left, let's get all three of you through here together, so try to help each other. Mm-hmm. And so it's not only incumbent on the administration and the faculty, but also the whole culture, the students also. How do we work together to support each other? And we put a number of programs, the president touched on a couple of them. One that I think we're particularly fond of is something called Clustered Learning Advocacy and Support for Students, where we look at every year as they progress through the programs, you know, what do freshmen need? Well, freshmen are coming into an environment they don't really understand and need some hand-holding on a new living experience, a new intellectual experience, and so on. And then moving along, as you become a junior or senior, well, you're worried about your portfolio to go out and present yourself for those opportunities the president talked about. And so how do you put together a portfolio that really represents your totality of work that you've done while you've been a student, and so on. And that's great preparation as they go into the workplace and continue to build their portfolio and support and so on.
And then how do you develop those personal skills and characteristics? And then we put certain structural mechanisms into place. We require all of our undergraduate students to live on the campus or in university-affiliated housing for the first 2 years, to have them really inculcated into the culture of the university, to get their feet under them, and so on. And that's part of the clustering. It's a residentially-based clustering. And we have live-in deans for clusters of houses. And then there is the developmental piece that John talked about for each year the student is there. And we call that time-based clustering. And we actually have assigned class deans, one for the first year students, the freshman class, is a sophomore, junior, senior. Then we have this phenomenon in the U.S. where, you know, at some universities, students are in these Greek letter organizations. And we even have a Greek deans, commons deans, to kind of make sure that, you know, these students live out and live through the kinds of principles and experiences we want all of our students to have. So that's what class stands for. And now we've extended it to graduate students. And so this clustered learning advocacy and support for students is important. And these deans are the advocates working with the academics. And people actually meet every week to discuss the students and particularly look at where their students, some student may be struggling and to try to intervene in the right way. So access is important, and that's where recruiting students, helping to deal with issues of differential preparation before they come, so that you're not saying, well, you're admitting some underqualified student, but you're addressing the issue, where you deal with financial aid, so that is not an impediment. But then if you're not dealing with what happens in terms of the culture of the place, in terms of the advocacy and support for students as they go along, then you have high attrition. And then if you aren't seeing to the kind of professional development opportunities that all the students must have, then you don't end up with the outcomes, the placement statistics, or the career outcomes that in the end we're about. And so all of this is in our plan, and what happens is we make commitments, and then every year we develop very specific what we call performance plans, where those commitments get translated into actual actions and initiatives. And then my whole leadership team, the cabinet, and the deans are held accountable for implementing their plan. So that's how we do it.
Well, good luck with the plan. Shirley Ann Jackson and John Kolb, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.